It's tempting to compare George Steele to the comic book Man of Steel. They're both tall and square-shouldered, both have boyish faces, and they share a mission to rescue a damsel in distress. By all accounts, the New York City Opera was in crisis when Mr. Steele signed on as its new general manager and artistic director last January. It was beset by financial problems and wrangling with its employee unions, and it had to suspend performances while its theater in Lincoln Center was being renovated. But next week, under Mr. Steele's direction, the company will launch a new, if somewhat abbreviated, season of performances in its refurbished home at Lincoln Center. And he's here now to talk about that upcoming season and the challenges that lie ahead. Welcome to our show.
Great to be here.
Let's talk about what's planned for next week. The opening gala on Thursday will feature American Voices, a program of songs from American operas and musicals. Why did you choose to open with choral performance rather than an opera?
Well, it's such a special occasion that we've just renovated the house. We spent $107 million refurbishing the place, and we wanted to show off everything that it can do, and we wanted to celebrate everything that New York City Opera is. And one of the great things that New York City Opera has done from the very beginning is to champion young American singers and American composers. And so we're having an evening that's all American music, music theater, opera, and also a visit from our friends at New York City Ballet.
Mm-hmm. And will there be any famous names among the singers?
Plenty of famous names. I mean, some of the great New York City Opera singers of all time. Sam Raimi will be there, Joyce DiDonato, Anna Christie, our own house divas, Amy Burton and Lauren Flanagan, some wonderful young singers. It's going to be a big show.
And Lauren Flanagan will be in the season's first opera, won't she?
That's right. Two nights later, she's singing the title role in Hugo Weisgerl's Esther, which we're reviving for the first time since we gave the world premiere in 1993.
Well, why now? Why not when Purim, during the
why not during Purim?
The Purim holiday season?
Yeah, I hear that from everybody I talk to about Esther. Well, we thought about Purim, but we're not in session during Purim this year, and B, I wanted to open my tenure at New York City Opera with a 20th century American opera, and it didn't take me very long to pick this glorious score, which I was actually thinking about for years before I came to New York City Opera.
Well, it did get great reviews when it opened, and yet new operas do have a problem being performed, don't they?
Yeah, there aren't that many new works that get performed, and of course there's a famous stigma about second performances. It's hard to get great works back. But that really didn't affect my thinking. It was really that the music was so incredibly wonderful. Even if this were the third performance, I would have the same feeling about it. It's one of the great American works of the 20th century.
And Lauren Flanagan sang the lead role in the original production?
In 1993, she credits it with really launching her. It was a big breakthrough moment for her. She says as a young woman, she said yes to this role without really looking at it closely, and it was a real bear. And this time, she said yes to it without remembering too much how difficult it was. But she's, in fact, fantastic. She sounds wonderful in it, and the whole cast is incredible.
You paired her with the original director, too.
Chris Mattigliano came back. It is the same production, and so we're happy to have Chris back directing it. One of the things that's not the same is in 1993, it was all old-school, really heavy-duty projectors. There are a lot of projections in the piece, and that's all been digitized now, so it looks very crisp and delicious.
Yeah, were you able to see the first performance?
In 93, I did not see it. I've only ever heard the piece and now seen it coming to the stage during rehearsal.
By the way, Lauren Flanagan will be a guest on Soundcheck tomorrow. That show comes on our FM side at 2 o'clock every weekday afternoon. Some people doubted that you'd be able to pull together an opera season on such short notice. You only started in the job, 8 months ago?
February 2nd.
Wow. Just putting together a new production of an opera is supposedly 4 years in the making, isn't it?
Wow. Is that true? Oops.
That's what they say.
Well,
of course, in the case of Esther, this is something that's been done before, but it hasn't been done at New York City Opera for
exactly
16
right.
years.
And it hasn't been done anywhere for 16 years. That's the extraordinary thing about Esther. I took over February 2nd. There were no singers hired for the season, and there were no operas programmed for the season. So it was a big challenge, but a really exciting one to get the staff together and to put together the season in very short order and to find pieces that represented the essential New York City Opera.
So when your predecessor, Gerald Motte, suddenly quit last fall, he left you nothing in place?
Well, he had some plans that he had moved forward on in varying degrees, but those were all products which had been abandoned because they all added up to way more money than the opera had.
And that was part of the problem.
As I understand
the reason
it,
he quit, he just felt that there wasn't enough money for him to do the job he wanted to do.
Basically, yes, exactly. That's essentially true. He imagined a much more expensive season than the opera had ever had, and it became clear to everybody that wasn't possible.
Well, that would also suggest that he had something that would in mind that would be similar to what the Metropolitan Opera does. What are the differences between the two and their missions in your mind?
The Metropolitan Opera and us?
Yeah. First of all, do you see yourselves as Peter Gelb was on the show recently. Do you see yourselves as collegial or are you rivals?
Oh, well, I mean, I suppose in some sense we're rivals. Peter's a terrific guy. I like him a lot personally. And, of course, I'm a huge fan of what he's doing across the plaza. But our two companies have had distinct identities for certainly as long as ours has been around. The Met's been around longer than New York City Opera, and New York City Opera was founded in many ways as an alternative to the Met. And I think when it's been its most successful, it's been crystal clear to the public the difference between the two places. We have, for instance, always championed young American singers. That's been a part of our mission. We've championed new repertoire. We give our first American world premiere, I think in 1948, William Grant Still's Troubled Island. We are historically the company that does crazy new music for the first time in New York City. So Die Soldaten that people saw last summer at Lincoln Center Festival, we did 10 years ago. And Moses und Aaron, I think we were 15 years before the Met. And a host of major 20th century scores, Love of Three Oranges. I could go on and on and on. We were the first company in the United States to have super titles, so you knew what the heck people were singing about. So all these kinds of, not only in terms of repertoire, but in terms of outreach to the public, which is one of the reasons Fiorella LaGuardia, as mayor, founded the company, was to create what he called the People's Opera. And we have put affordable tickets as a number one part of our mission from the earliest days. So a quarter of the tickets we're selling next season are $25 or less.
But of the five operas you've announced for the upcoming season, two of them are the sorts of things we also would see at the Met, Mozart's Don Giovanni and Puccini's Madama Butterfly. Does the New York City Opera have a different way presenting them?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you come see our Don Giovanni, which is a new production this year, it's directed by Christopher Alden, who's a regular director at New York City Opera, one of the great directors in the world. It's an incredibly fresh and exciting production, and the cast is absolutely spectacular. It's a relatively young cast, largely American. Let me see. It's one of the singers is Ukrainian-American, so that makes her largely American anyway. Fantastic cast. They've been in a very long rehearsal process, which is focused equally on music and acting. So there's a kind of ensemble work. I think it would be harder for a really gigantic house to pull off. We've had the singers for a very long time. And there's a lightness of spirit that comes with those kinds of young singers that I think is totally appropriate, particularly for Mozart's comedies, and I count Don Giovanni for all of its strangeness as one of his comedies. It's a wonderful match, New York City Opera and Mozart.
And Mr. Alden wasn't daunted by having to pull together a major production, a whole new production in such a brief time?
Well, it was a daunting task for everybody, but Christopher I've known for a number of years. Way, way back, we worked on a project together called Hopper's Wife, and then when I was up at Miller Theater, he directed Elliot Carter's What Next, which we gave the New York stage premiere of. So he and I have worked together a lot, and the challenges were real on time, but kind of fun challenges to attack. I mean, even on the casting side, the casts are spectacular, but in a sense, it was quite easy. Either somebody's free or they're not free. Mm-hmm. So it's a relatively easy matter.
That's the other problem with opera, isn't it? That you call up a singer and you say, I'd like you to be in something 6 months from now, and they say, gee, I'm booked up for 3 years.
Yeah, but I mean, it's as I say, if you want to put... Let's say you want to have a movie star be in a thing. Well, the movie star doesn't know whether he or she is free until about a week prior, and then they're free. Mm. You know what I mean? So they're either booked 6 years in advance or 2 weeks in advance. So there is that we benefited from the flip side of that. It's not that I want to keep casting with very short notice, but there was no loss of spectacular singers. We got all of our first choices.
My guest is George Steele, who is the new general manager and artistic director of the New York City Opera, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with George Steele, who is the general manager and artistic director of the New York City Opera. He's been in the job since last February, and he seems to settle things down. You have a schedule. What are some of the other operas that you'll be performing this season?
Well, the fall, as I say, we open a week from today with a gala, All American Music, and then 2 days later, Esther opens. And the day after that, if you can imagine, that's Sunday the 8th, a brand new production of Don Giovanni with a great cast. And that's it for the fall. Our fall season is a little truncated because construction on the building has continued through most of October. And then we come back in the spring, reopening in March with L'Étoile of Chabrier. I'm a total junkie for Chabrier's music. People don't really know much of it. He's a wonderful composer. I guess they're properly operettas because they're spoken text.
Well, Anthony Tomasini called it one of the best-kept secrets of the 19th century in a story that he wrote a couple of months ago in the New York Times.
Well, I feel the same way about Chabrier. It's just fantastic. And L'Étoile, the translation, of course, the star, but it's really the horoscope. It's a hilarious comedy about a king who has a horoscope, and I'll go on and on. But again, here, I would say the casting is something very special to look at. This trio of young women, Jennifer Zetlin, Julie Bullien, and Liza Forrester, singing this trio of French gals. It's spectacular. Wonderful, wonderful. And the great Jean-Paul Fouchercourt is coming back to sing the role of King Ouf. He sang a title role in a big Mark Morris production of Platé at New York City Opera a few years ago, made a smash.
And then you're also going to be performing Handel, something that the New York City Opera has been doing a lot over the years.
Exactly. Handel is one of the great specialties of New York City Opera, and we've been one of the forces worldwide in bringing Handel's operas back to the stage. This is his great opera, Partenope. Cindy Acedin is singing the title role, and again, a spectacular cast. Two marvelous countertenors, an Englishman called Yestin Davies, and then a young American, Anthony Roth Costanzo, one of the great voices of our time, I think. And Christian Kernan, Englishman conducting. It should be terrific.
And what is Partenope about?
Well, Partenope is about a queen who really has a boyfriend I think she'd like to marry, but there's a sort of hilarious sex farce about, it's literally a comedy, about a collection of suitors who are coming to try to win her hand, including a woman disguised as a man pretending to be a suitor. There's all of those hilarious layers of gender confusion that are so typical of Baroque opera.
Now, I'm assuming that you're already working on next year's programs.
Yes, heavily.
And will you be repeating some of these things, or will they be all new productions?
Well, next year, no. None of these, this year's five, will happen. And we should mention the fifth, of course, is Madama Butterfly, which you noted, but it's also a spectacular cast. Xu Ying Li is giving me a reprieve, singing Cho-Cho-San. And there's an incredible baritone singing sharp. It's called Quinn Kelsey. It's a big mountain of a guy from Hawaii. He's one of the great Verdi baritones of our time.
And will this be an older production?
It's a Mark Lammas production. We've actually given it on television. It was part of Live from Lincoln Center and won an Emmy Award. It's a beautiful, minimalist is too strong a word, but it's full of shoji screens and sort of Japanese-y look.
Now, this season, you're also offering discounted tickets for about a quarter of the seats at every performance. Was that discount your idea?
Well, I decided to expand it. We have a program called Opera for All where people can get essentially rush tickets, $25, and sit in really great seats. That's an idea that's found some currency elsewhere. And we're still continuing that program, so you can sit in the orchestra for $25. But we wanted to make sure that there were affordable tickets for everyone. In fact, tickets begin at $12, if you can imagine.
Wow.
If you sit in the fifth ring, and we've sold out the fifth ring for our gala. But we want to make sure you can come to the opera for the price of a movie.
Because you must be concerned that some people have kind of drifted away over this period when the opera was forced to discontinue performances.
Well, yeah, this last year there were no stage productions. There were concerts all around the city, and in many ways we reconnected with some old and new audiences. Sure, I mean, when I was looking at the opera, I was worried, are you coming back after a year? You have some difficulty with ticket sales and also, frankly, with fundraising. But then I looked at the numbers, and last season, in a year when the opera did no performances, they raised 90% of what they would raise in a regular year. So there's incredible loyalty among the donors.
Because that is a concern, that classical music and opera is losing its younger base, and you seem to be doing all sorts of things to hold on to them.
Well, it's been my mission for the 12 or 14 years I've been in this racket to bring in new audiences, to see new things. And I think the secret to that is doing thrilling repertoire that's exciting no matter who you are, opera insider or opera novice, making sure that ticket prices are accessible and making sure that you're reaching people in interesting ways. And I have to say, particularly with opera, not presuming that people already know the repertoire. It's one of the greatest sins of opera marketing. There's this tremendous suggestion that if you don't already know the piece, you probably shouldn't come. And that's the opposite of New York City opera. That's why Beverly Sills got us to have super titles in the first place, so you could walk in the door off the street and know exactly what was going on in this glorious music.
You're also putting up art installations and other things that might attract an audience that might not otherwise even consider opera.
Well, absolutely. New York City Opera has a long history of collaborating with serious artists in other forms, particularly the visual arts. But, Maurice Sendak, for instance, created three or four different productions for us. And this year we commissioned this wonderful artist, Evie Day, to make an installation in the Promenade with this gorgeous public space. And, in fact, there's a public viewing of that next Friday in the evening. You can get the details from our website, nycopera.com. But Evie, I took her to the costume warehouse we have, where we had a bunch of retired costumes, and she has turned them into sculpture. That's one of the mediums she works in, is, as she calls it, exploded couture. She had a wonderful piece called Bride Fight that was two bridal gowns exploding in midair caught on fishing line. And she's taken these old costumes from Carmen, from Butterfly, from Lucia, everything, and suspended them up in the air and sort of deconstructed them in quite beautiful ways.
I've wondered why the New York City Opera Company chose to take a year off rather than find a temporary space for its performances last year. I know you weren't part of that decision, but there are empty theaters in New York, and I'm sure that there was some Broadway house that would have been happy to have.
Yeah. Well, I was not here, as you point out, but I know that they looked into it.
Because you had to pay to fulfill contracts, so people were being paid to do no work, weren't they?
I'll answer your first question, then I'll answer your second. But they did look at the possibility of doing operas elsewhere, and the reality is it costs even more money to put on an opera. It's one thing to do nothing. It's expensive. It was costly for the opera to be dark to allow the renovations to go on, but I'm certain that when people see how spectacular these renovations are, as I say, $107 million worth of them, much thanks to the great generosity of David H. Koch, after whom we've renamed the theater, they will see that that was a worthwhile decision. In terms of the costs of not doing business, they are real costs. I wouldn't say that our performers did nothing last year. We, in fact, gave concerts around the city. But for sure, the opera made, I thought, the very noble decision. Again, it precedes me, so I can't take any credit for it, to make good on its commitments to its artists, even in a year where it wasn't performing, which I think is sets a very high benchmark.
Isn't David H. Koch the second richest man in New York City after Michael Bloomberg?
I don't follow those things. I hear that they surpass each other.
He's also run for office.
David has?
Yeah, as a libertarian candidate.
Yeah, libertarian, good man. David is a very wealthy guy, an extremely successful businessman, an incredibly nice guy, and incredibly devoted to the arts. And this is the largest single gift in the history of Lincoln Center. I want to reemphasize how spectacular and visionary it is. It has totally transformed the hall, some ways that are invisible. For instance, we have a brand new media suite that we can capture everything going on stage in high-definition video and Dolby 5.1 audio. There are something like 80 or 90 broadcast service plates around the theater where you can plug in a camera, replace the entire lighting system, the HVAC system, the brand new seats for everyone to sit in, and we've added aisles to the theater for the first time in its history. So it's we've kept the same very generous legroom it had and now added aisles. We call it business class seating at the opera.
So now we have the opera in a new house, and we have Alice Tully Hall also renovated. The theater, the New York State Theater, now the David Koch Theater, was originally designed by Philip Johnson, but the opera company had been unhappy with it for years, not the New York City Ballet. What did the New York City Ballet do during the
renovations?
Of renovations?
Well, the renovation was a project cooked up jointly by the opera and the ballet, and there are many, many things, many improvements for both companies. I think what you're saying, there's an old canard that the hall was good for ballet but bad for music, which is, of course, crazy.
Were the acoustics bad?
It was a little dry in the theater.
I've always wondered why. Forgive me for a second.
Not at
but
all.
You're somebody who's been in this business for a while. I've always wondered why a concert hall, with all we know now about acoustics, why so many of them have to be fixed up and get it. Alice Tully, Avery Fisher, your house.
Well, I would say, A, all we know now is not a lot. We don't know a lot now. But in the case of our house, there were very, very simple, common sense changes that have brought about marvelous improvements in the way the hall sounds. So there was carpet all on the back wall of the theater at every level. And I know for years I sat back there, and it was my Walter Mitty dream to kind of be able to be in the company and say, let's get the carpet off the back wall. But it has come to pass. The theater sounds delicious, and the orchestra pit has now been greatly enlarged. It's now on an elevator. We can adjust the height. And the orchestra pit used to be plywood right on top of concrete, so there was no acoustic room underneath for bass residents, for instance, to develop. And now that it's the beautiful manifold space underneath the orchestra pit, it sounds fantastic.
Now, you're in management, but weren't you a singer once, and hadn't you also been interested in conducting?
I guess I'm not much of a singer anymore, but I'm still certainly a conductor. But I sang for years and years. I was a choir boy as a kid, and after my voice changed, I became a countertenor. So as I like to tell people, you know, they say, do you do period instrument work? I say, I am a period instrument. I sang for a long time. My last regular singing gig was at St. Thomas Church, Fifth Avenue here in New York, and I had to give it up because producing took too much time. But conducting is something I still do. I'm not doing a lot this season deliberately so that I can focus on the opera and all the work to be done there. But I'll do a couple of things. I have an annual holiday concert at the Guggenheim and a few small things.
Well, you could also hire yourself as a conductor for the New York City Opera.
Well, you know, why not? The answer is we have a spectacular music director in George Manahan. He himself is a wonderful musician, and he's worked with our orchestra there, sounding fantastic. And I think I will do something, I hope, with the orchestra. I'll talk to George about what the right thing is and the right time. But we've got a great man at the helm, and I'm doing everything I can to give him what he needs to do his job.
George Steele is the general manager and artistic director of the New York City Opera, now in its beautifully refurbished building, and soon to begin performances again. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. It's a joy to be here.